Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to the Haunted Collection with your host, author, paranormal investigator, and haunted collector, Kevin Kane. I know I've been missing in action for a couple of weeks, so I apologize for this show coming to you a little later than it should have. But I assure you tonight I'll make up for it with a couple of nice, awesome, gruesome horror stories for you. First, I just want to let you know what's going on. As far as my writing, I am working on a new book called The Blood Painting. This is a novel, and it's based on some true incidents. The story concerns a very mysterious painting with an evil energy attached, which can cause a person to go strange and even violent. So I hope to have that novel completed and out later this year. In the meantime, if you have not checked out my novel, my last novel, Into the Vortex, be sure to go to www.writerkevinkane.com and pick up a copy for yourself. Into the Vortex was the sequel to my first novel, Haunts, which concerns medium Marla Hollingsworth and SPA, Students of Paranormal Activity, a paranormal group who goes out and investigates real haunted locations and battles between good and evil. So be sure to check those books out, Haunts and Into the Vortex. You can also find those on Amazon, Books a Million, Barnes & Noble, and other fine online book retailers. And again, you can order autographed copies right on my website, www.writerkevinkane.com. So now let's get down to business. Oh, I can't wait to share with you this first story tonight. In fact, as I'm sitting here talking, it's a dark and rainy, stormy night outside my house right now. The cat is in the window crawling all over the place, so if you hear any background noise, I do apologize. It's not a creepy ghost, it's just a silly furball of a cat. So, let's get to our first story. This is a story which took place here in my home state of Alabama, down in the southern part of the state, I've been told. I first heard this story when I was only in elementary school, so I was a small boy, and it gave me the freaking creeps, and I hope it will for you tonight when I retell this story. I'm not sure if it's true, I'm not sure if it's false, but I know it certainly is creepy, and I hope you enjoy it. It's called The Baby. Back in the 1930s, during the World War I, there was a young woman named Elizabeth who lived in South Alabama. Her husband had to go off to war, and he was fighting overseas. Elizabeth was pregnant with her child. Unfortunately, she had to give birth to the child while her husband was away at war. Several months later, after the child was born, she received a letter notifying her that her husband had been killed during action in the war. Saddened by this news and scared of having to raise a baby all by herself, Elizabeth did the only thing she knew to do at the time. She decided to take the baby somewhere where a loving couple could raise the baby for her. She took a walk down the path from her house and went a long way around until she came to a farmhouse she knew about where a nice older couple lived. She decided to leave the baby in a basket, swaddled up in a blue blanket to keep it warm. Placing the basket on the stoop of the front door, she gave a loud knock on the door with her fist, and then scurried away into the darkness. What she did not know was that the older couple was away traveling and would not be back for a couple of days. When the couple returned, they found the basket. They found the blue blanket. They found it ripped to pieces and stained with blood. The remains of the child were found near the edge of the woods. A pack of wolves had been seen in the area near that farmhouse and in the town nearby. Judging by the wounds on the baby's body, it was determined that those wolves, most likely having heard the baby's lonely cries of hunger, had followed the sounds and turned the poor child into their evening meal. What a miserable thing. It wasn't long until Elizabeth caught news of the incident and went into a crying rage. She blamed herself for the death of her little child and wished she'd never left it there. Unable to forgive herself, she went to the spot in the cemetery a few days later where the remains of her baby were buried and killed herself with a knife. The townspeople buried her body next to the child. Years and years went by, and then locals began claiming that they saw the apparition of a weeping woman in black clothing running through the cemetery in search of her baby. They knew it was Elizabeth, and she was looking for her poor little baby that she left to die that cold night long ago. And sometimes they would hear the cry of an infant echoing over the tombstones. Many people would go out to see if they could catch a glimpse of the ghost or hear the baby cry. Well, a few brave souls did. Most people were too afraid to try it. During the late 1950s, a teenage couple named Betsy and Russell, who were students at the local high school, decided they would go out to the cemetery to park and have their own little private party. Russell wanted to see if they could catch sight of the ghost, but he didn't take the story very seriously. Mainly, he was more interested in making out with Betsy than watching a bunch of tombstones all night. Betsy at first wasn't too thrilled about the prospect of going to a cemetery and spending hours there in the dark, but her boyfriend Russell talked her into it, so they decided to go out there the very next Friday night. When the evening came, he brought her out and took her to a meal first, just to smooth things over a bit, and then, seeing that her nerves were a bit relaxed, Russell took her on out to the cemetery where they parked, in a spot nearest to where the ghost of the woman had been seen. Truth be told, a lot of teenagers had parked in that area just to smoke or make out or drink beer. Russell left the headlights on and the engine running and the radio playing, looked about and noticed, thankfully, no one was there tonight. So he decided this would be the opportune time to make his move. He and Betsy began to kiss and make out, wrapped in each other's arms. So heated was their session that the windows around the car began to steam up because of the cold air outside and the heat from their bodies. After a while, Betsy glanced out up at the window through the steamed glass of that windshield. She swore she saw in the darkness beyond, just past the headlights, the figure of a woman suddenly rush past just by the beams of the headlight. A woman with her hands buried across her face as if she were crying. Betsy pushed Russell away and pointed out the windshield, shouting, "Look, look, there's a woman out there. I saw her." Russell thought that Betsy was just trying to make up a story to give him the brush off and help to keep his distance from her, but he was more the wiser. "Ah, come on, Betsy." But she continued to insist, "Russell, I'm serious. There really is a woman out there. I saw her run right by the headlights out there. She looks so upset." "You think it's the ghost?" She frowned at him. I think it might be someone who needs help. Maybe she's in trouble or lost. Russell was reluctant to get out of the car and go out into the darkness to search for this alleged woman. But Betsy's anxious look changed his mind, and he decided to go for it. If nothing else, to ease Betsy's mind and get her back in the mood. He stepped out of the car, told Betsy to lock it behind him, and walked off into the darkness in search of the figure. Betsy stayed behind in the car with the doors locked and listened to the radio while she awaited his return. She waited and waited for what seemed like a long time, and Russell did not come back. The keys were still in the ignition and the engine running. She decided perhaps she should drive a little way through the cemetery and look for herself to see if she could find Russell or maybe this woman she'd seen. Her mind made up, she moved over to the driver's side and took it out of gear. The car began to roll forward. Before she could brake or accelerate, something darted toward the car through the headlights and seemed to fall toward the ground and disappear underneath the front end. Betsy felt the front tire bump over something as she immediately stopped the car and put it back in park. What was that? She listened to the night outside for a noise. Was it perhaps an animal that she hit? Whatever it was moved too fast for her to know what it was. Then suddenly, tap, screet, tap, screet, tap, screet. Something came from the back of the car behind Betsy, a strange noise, like a tapping and a dragging. Something like the sound of a thing being dragged across the lid of the back trunk. Tap, screet, tap, screet. Betsy froze there in the driver's seat, her eyes wide and riveted to the windshield ahead, afraid to turn around and look. Tap, screet. It sounded as if it now dragged up the back window. Then it started across the top of the car. Tap, screet. Tap, screet. Tap, screet. Tap, screet. Something slid along the roof of the car toward the front. Betsy remained frozen in place. It felt like ice crawling down her skin. The chills ran in a wave across her back as she listened. Tap, screet. Tap, screet. Tap, screet. Whatever it was, made it to the front. Before it could come onto the windshield, Betsy closed her eyes tight and prayed to God above. Oh, please, dear Lord, please, please don't let this be anything bad. Please let this just be some animal on the car or something. Please. Then she heard, as something slid down the windshield halfway and then stopped. Silence. Taking a deep breath and exhaling, she waited. No other sounds came. She finally opened her eyes and looked. At first, all she saw was the steam covering the glass. However, something just beyond seemed to be lying across the glass. It looked like some blurry, weird object. She slowly reached out her shaky hand and wiped at the steam on the glass to get a better look. There before her, lying on the windshield and peering in with a tiny hand pressed against the glass, was the small form of a tattered, bloody baby looking in. There were rips and tears across its face where flesh had been torn away and blood caked all over. The blue blanket wrapped around it was tattered and pulled halfway away from its body, revealing all sorts of claw marks and bites and tears all over its body. It peered in at her with eyes black as a moonless sky. It opened its mouth and it let out the loudest, most piercing wail that she had ever heard in her life. Bessie screamed and she screamed and she screamed into the night. The next morning, the police, having received a report of two missing teenagers, drove by the cemetery on a hunch that maybe the two kids were probably out there necking and having a makeout session, as a lot of local teens did, and they probably just fell asleep out there in their vehicle. Well, they spotted Russell's car sitting out there and drove out to it. But what they found was not a pretty sight. Russell was found underneath the front of the car. What Betsy had felt when she drove forward, that bump, was actually Russell. He appeared to have been running back to the car. Running from something? We'll never know, but he was in a hurry. Unfortunately, he slid on the muddy ground when he reached the car and fell under the front of the car as it rolled over him and crushed him to death. Betsy never knew. Inside the car, they found Betsy curled up just like a child in the floorboard of the front passenger side. She was whimpering, shaking. She had screamed so much the night before that her voice was now hoarse. As they tried to pull her from the car, all she could do was whisper, just barely whisper, "No, no, get it away, get it away, on the windshield, get it away." On the windshield. Get it away. The police officer looked on the windshield. What he saw looked like the bloody claw marks of something that had slid across the front of the car's windshield and underneath the windshield wiper, pinned under the blade, was a piece of blue, tattered, bloody blanket. That was a spooky story when I first heard it. I do apologize, a call almost came through on my phone right there at the end of the story, so if there is a break there, a little cut in my talk there, please forgive me. People pick the most ridiculous times to send their little robot callers to people's phones. Well, maybe I'll just send that bloody little baby to give them a visit. I know that was a horrible thing, but at least he's out there somewhere having a good time scaring people. Well, we have time for one more story on this rainy, dark night, and I'm going to continue. This is a nice, creepy story called A Piece of Wire. No one could be found to dispute the observation that Buddy Edwards was a bully. Least of all, Buddy Edwards. He was quite proud of his notorious reputation. For as long as anyone could remember, he had been a bully. He had always been big for his age, and by the time he was in seventh grade, he was almost 6 feet tall and weighed over 180 pounds. In school, he was a bully, stealing lunch money from his smaller and weaker schoolmates and making them do his homework because he was a big lazy bum. The teachers all knew what he was doing and what was going on, but they were afraid of him too. Even his parents were afraid of him. Yes, Buddy Edwards was one mean and nasty kid. He never outgrew his role as school buddy, as school bully. My apologies. At the age of 23, he was still pushing around those who were smaller and weaker than he was. That meant he was pushing practically everyone around. Buddy was no mental heavyweight, but he was smart enough to know how to keep out of real trouble. He didn't commit any big crimes, the kind that might, you know, get him a couple of years in the slammer. He was afraid of that. Usually, he stayed on the right side of the law, barely, but enough to keep him out of jail. He didn't run with any tough gangs either. Down deep, he was afraid of them too. Buddy was always scared when he thought he might be put in a position where someone would be able to push him around. He was not really a criminal. He was a bully. He wanted to dominate others. And like most bullies, he was basically a coward. When he walked, Buddy would somehow take up the whole sidewalk, forcing people into the gutter or up against buildings. When he came into a restaurant or a bar, he took people's favorite booths, blew smoke in their faces, insulted their girlfriends. But his principal instrument of aggression was his motorcycle. Buddy owned a huge motorcycle. He had adjusted it so that it made more noise than a jet plane at takeoff. It was the loudest motorcycle anyone had ever heard, and Buddy loved it. He would roar up and down the quiet streets at midnight, and lights would go on all over town. The police were often called, but nobody was ever willing to sign a complaint against Buddy. They were all afraid that he would get them later. So he always went free. He was a real menace to bike riders, even little kids on bikes. He would roar past, nearly sideswiping them, causing heaven knows how many scraped knees and bent wheels as bicycles went out of control and crashed just to avoid him. He would sometimes challenge cars, if he knew the drivers, by suddenly cutting in front of them. More than one car wound up in a ditch or crumpled a fender around a pole, trying to avoid Buddy Edwards and his motorcycle. And he would just ride by again, laughing at the unfortunate driver and making obscene gestures. There were some who wished that they hadn't swerved to avoid him, but Buddy knew instinctively that they always would. They didn't have the guts to hit him, and he always took advantage of that certain knowledge. Charlie Sebring and Roger Platt had, to their misfortune, known Buddy Edwards for many years. Buddy had bullied and terrorized them through school. Just the other day, he had forced Charlie's car off the road with his motorcycle. It took a tow truck to get Charlie's car out of the ditch. Buddy just watched and laughed. Charlie was still seething, not merely from his most recent humiliation, but from the years of torment at the hands of the bully. He was talking in dead earnest to Roger. Both had already consumed a few drinks by then. "That guy's no joke," Charlie said. "He's a deadly menace. I could have been killed being run off the road like that." One day he really is going to kill someone. Something has to be done about him before he does. "Sure, sure," said Ralph. He had heard it all before. He had said it all before. "Who's going to do anything, you or me? Even if he gets arrested, it'll be a few weeks in jail, and then he's back out on the street after us. There's nothing we can do about it," Ralph continued. There never has been, and there never will be. Yes, there is, said Charlie. I've got a plan. It's something I've been thinking about for a couple of days. We can fix him good, and he'll never know who did it. Suddenly, Ralph was interested. Fixing Buddy Edwards good was something that he had always wanted to do, particularly if Buddy never knew who fixed him. Okay, what's your plan? Now, you know where he lives down by Four Corners. In order to get home, he comes from Miller's Hill and over the Black Creek Bridge. He comes that way every night. Now, let's say somebody strung a piece of wire across the end of the bridge, just about chest high. When he came to the bridge, he would hit the wire, and it would knock him right off his motorcycle. Maybe the motorcycle would even get wrecked, and then we wouldn't have to worry about it anymore. Ralph thought for a moment. Sounds dangerous. I mean, he could be pretty badly hurt getting knocked off his motorcycle like that. Guys like Buddy are too tough to get badly hurt. Besides, does he ever worry about someone getting hurt when he forces them off the road? I could have been killed the other day. He'll just have to take his chances. Ralph said, the police would suspect us of stringing up the wire. No, Charlie said. Maybe. Maybe they would suspect half the people in town. And the police don't like Buddy any better than we do. Do you think they would waste a lot of time trying to find out who did something to him? Ralph hesitated for a moment. But the memory of 1,000 injuries at the hands of that bully, plus the foolhardy courage brought on by a few drinks, confirmed his decision. All right, Charlie, when do we do it? Tonight, said Charlie, I have a piece of wire in my car. They drove to the vicinity of the Black Creek Bridge and parked about half a mile away. They decided to string the wire up where Buddy would be leaving the bridge. They figured that as he crossed the bridge, he would have to slow down, and thus he would not slam into the wire at high speed. We want to scare him, said Charlie, not kill him. And Ralph agreed. After putting up the wire, the two men hid in a clump of bushes and waited. It wasn't long before they heard the familiar roar of Buddy Edwards' motorcycle coming over Miller's Hill. They could see the headlight as it reached the crest of the hill and started down toward the bridge. He's going awfully fast, said Ralph. He better slow down over the bridge. But he didn't. Perhaps he had been drinking. Perhaps he always went too fast. Whatever the reason, Buddy Edwards hit the wire at a tremendous speed. Vroom! They saw the motorcycle continue straight forward, while Buddy's body was flung backwards, and they feared they saw something else. Oh my God! Gasped Ralph. The motorcycle crashed into a tree not far from where the two men were hidden. Buddy's body had been thrown onto the bridge. At least most of it had. When police investigated the scene, they found Buddy's head was missing. The wire had been strung just a bit too high, and instead of catching Buddy in the chest, it got him in the neck. And the impact sliced his head right off. The police assumed that the head had been thrown into the creek and washed away. In any event, it was never found. But from that day and since, people tell of strange and unexplainable lights near that bridge, and in the road leading to it. The light is said to be Buddy's motorcycle light, and those who dare get close enough say they see the headless body sitting on top of that motorcycle, blood still dripping from the stump of his neck as he roars over the bridge looking for his head. But don't get too close, because he might just decide to take yours Ladies and gentlemen, that is my episode of The Haunted Collection, and I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you so much, as always, for your support and for tuning in, and I look forward to coming back in a few more weeks to share some more stories for you. Until then, keep those doors and windows locked. Keep yourself safe. Stay out of the rain. Stay away from bridges and away from cemeteries. And for the love of all humanity, happy hauntings!